Broadcasting from Manhattan Beach and the World Wide Web, you're listening to CHSR, HealthyLife.net.
As a service to our listeners, this program is for general information and entertainment purposes only. CHSRHealthyLife.net does not recommend, endorse, or object to the views, products, or topics expressed or discussed by show hosts or their guests. We suggest you always consult with your own personal, medical, financial, or legal advisor.
Greetings, or may I say Bojo and Potawatomi, to those joining us for today's Indigenous Perspective Show. I'm Randy Kwiatkowski, an enrolled Potawatomi tribal member and the co-host of Indigenous Perspectives.
And I'm Carolyn Schmidt, the other co-host. For our land acknowledgement, we recognize Vermont, where we are, as part of Endakina, which is the unceded traditional territory of the Abenaki people, who for centuries have lived on these lands, now included in present-day northern New England and southeastern Canada.
We also acknowledge that this is the unceded land of our other-than-human kin, the winged ones, the rooted ones, the four-legged ones, and the mountains and rivers, who have been present on Turtle Island and have been partners and caretakers for countless millennia. They were here before the arrival of any of the two-legged, before the indigenous peoples who came over the Beringian land bridge from Asia more than 15,000 years ago, and before the European two-legged arrived more recently.
Today's program is about transformation and survival. It recognizes that broad segments of the public today are struggling with anxieties about environmental, social, economic, and political uncertainties, and it often feels like things are bordering on chaos. We're offering a relevant story about Indigenous peoples in North America who lived through similar and actually far more extreme crises, who worked their way out of despair by engaging in highly creative individual and collective acts of transformation. So there's a lot we feel that we all can learn from their experiences.
In that spirit, we invite you to use your imagination to travel back in time and join us in Chicago on May 1st, 1893. President Cleveland is addressing a crowd of 200,000 people attending the official opening of the World's Columbian Exposition. The event, also referred to as a World's Fair, is designed to showcase achievements of the United States, which are being portrayed as rivaling those of Europe. The theme of the Chicago Expo is explicit and triumphalist. In the 400 years since Columbus had set foot in the Western Hemisphere, a new society has arisen to the acme of civilization.
At least from the point of view of the Expo organizers and the many people who flooded in to experience it. In order to experience how far this new United States American civilization had come, and how far they thought it had progressed from the purportedly primitive, undeveloped state in which Europeans had found the Western Hemisphere, a reconstructed Indian village has been erected at the Expo. It's part of an illustration of the before stage of before and after people and lives, before being the indigenous people, after being the late 19th century technology and cultural achievements like electric lighting, which was a big deal at the Expo.
We intentionally use the words reconstructed Indian village because there had been a long established presence of Native Americans on the place, which came to be known as Chicago. Those original Native American occupants are my Potawatomi ancestors. Chicago is an English approximation of Chicago, our word for the smell of wild onions. We were forcibly removed from these lands, where the Expo now is, in 1838.
Listeners may well be sensing that this is going to be a struggle for Randy to deal with his awareness of how his family intimately is connected with the areas in which the Expo is occurring, and more on that we'll unwind as we discuss further this, what happened at the expo. So the expo's reconstructed indigenous village and the presence of indigenous peoples were carefully stage managed. By this time, late 19th century, the fabric of indigenous society was in what many in mainstream society assumed was its final unraveling under pressure such as forced assimilation at the residential schools, by the fact that many Indian religious ceremonies were legally banned, and of course, the loss of land. With the benefit of hindsight, and with the advantage of witnessing the revival of indigenous cultures today, we can now begin to understand that this Chicago 1893 exposition actually marks a great transformation, but it's not the transformation of vanishing indigenous people into assimilated white society that the expo organizers thought was their message. Instead, we can see it as the start of a survival and renewal transformation whose seeds were sown by Native hands. That transformation story was actually on display with colorful masks used by Pacific Northwest indigenous peoples, though not many of the majority attenders really got the point.
Before we see those masks and that story, we need to take a look behind the facade that was the expo's public face, its mask. It was created by hastily renovating existing buildings and by creating temporary giant structures, many of which were mere wooden forms plastered over to look like enduring stone structures. This was, in a very real sense, a mask covering colonial society, put on to disguise its troubling history, and also in order to project an image of European elegance.
So, Randy, I think you're trying to make the point that a lot is being stage managed and a lot is not real, but it's what the organizers are trying to impose their view of reality.
You got it. So complementing these illusions, expo organizers are showcasing living examples of how Indians lived so-called primitively and how they are being taught skills needed to be productive members of white society. Young men display carpentry skills they were taught at Indian residential schools. My own family's Aunt Emma Johnson, a Potawatomi, is making an appearance on her ancestral homeland at age 17. She's displaying sewing skills she's learned at a residential school.
So, Randy, just to clarify, your Aunt Emma is illustrating sort of an in-between stage for the indigenous people, like she's wearing, sort of white settler attire, and she's showing sewing just like she's been taught. So she's going to look like someone who's getting ready to take a place in the mainstream society.
She's one of the many variations on evolutionary success at the fair, and her particular brand, if you wish, that she's illustrating is that some of these primitive indigenous people can be rescued by teaching them white mainstream skills. Yeah.
Okay, so let's, in our imaginations, keep on walking past the residential school workers and find some of the other indigenous people invited to the expo. And these are supposed to be the quote-unquote before stage of evolution. We can follow the crowd to where the Kwakwaka'wakw from the Pacific Northwest coast are performing a dance. 15 Kwakwaka'wakw have traveled for 6 months to this Chicago area. They're living and performing daily just outside of the expo's anthropology building. So this leads to the question, why did they travel all the way to Chicago from their homeland, which is near today's Vancouver, British Columbia? What was behind that decision?
Well, the Kwakwaka'wakw, who actually, for many people who are not aware of the new names that indigenous people currently prefer to use, were historically referred to very famously in the United States and around the world as the Kwaki Utl. So when you hear Kwakwaka'wakw, let your brains make that association, and then this group that might sound very exotic suddenly might be familiar. So the question why did the Kwakwaka'wakw travel all the way to Chicago from their homeland is a really complicated and a really troubling question. First of all, they came because they were allowed to publicly perform dance ceremonies that Carolyn mentioned had been banned in the United States and Canada. Tribal members were being jailed for performing these. There were some underground, invisible performances still going on, but there was really brutal repression of these dances. So under the guise of being mere illustrations of a disappearing group, the Kwakwaka'wakw found this was at least one place where they could have a public stage on which to perform their most sacred rituals.
Okay, let me ask. First, it sounds like the expo was bending some laws to have these performances performed openly in public. Do you think it's at least partly because they felt that it wasn't a dangerous, empowering thing because the performers were doing it not in their own homeland with their own people, but doing it on stage?
Yeah, it's merely a show. It's merely a performance for the fair organizers. So the context here is that these were banned. These dances were banned because the government and anthropologists and ethnologists understood that these dances fired up Native Americans. They alleged, actually stated openly, that things like, you know, Custer being defeated at the Battle of what we call Greasy Grass was the result of Indians getting just absolutely fired up and animated by the dances. So the way you solve the Indian problem, as they called it, is prevent the dance, which leads to the uprisings. So yes, if they're just dancing for white people as opposed to their own people, that's no threat.
Wow, that also shows a sense among the both Canadian and United States governments in trying to ban these dances, these ceremonies, that they are truly empowering because they're affirming the traditional indigenous culture and beliefs, and the people are giving themselves strength. So obviously the ceremonies have a tremendous value, and to it's sort of like trying to get people from stopping their speaking their native language. You know, you're trying to undercut the basic foundations of the people's culture.
Indeed. And I mean, there's a bit of a contradiction here at the expo. On the one hand, the whole theme is the Indians are vanishing. That was what the newspapers said. Come and see them at the fair before they vanish. You know, they'll be gone in a few years. The federal government had that policy. And, you know, on the other hand, the society is still terrified of Indian uprisings, which had happened in the memory of most of the people attending the fair. So let me continue for the complicated answer to your question, why the Kwakwaka'wakw came. One is that they actually wanted to take advantage of anthropologists' interest in capturing and salvaging the last traces of their culture, because they felt that maybe they stood some remote chance of bending the minds and opening the minds of anthropologists and the public by showing who they were, not just primitive indigenous people disappearing, but people who have a rich culture, who have, you know, beautiful artifacts and beautiful ceremonies. So they maybe were a bit naive, but again, you know, it's a long shot and they didn't have much else to go on. So they're coming to the fair to do this. Now, it's hard to understand this for contemporaries, but in the late 19th century, anthropology was a new, quote, science, and it was on the rise. And anthropologists were consulted constantly by the government on issues of indigenous peoples on the Western frontier, which still wasn't settled. So people like Franz Boas, a German anthropologist, was studying the Kwakwaka'wakw in particular. He had encountered them in Germany. He had been really impressed when he first saw the dance. It would actually be accurate to say he was completely blown away by it, because he had been measuring their heads to find out, you know, whether they're more or less primitive from people who have bigger heads. And it suddenly occurred to him that maybe culture is more important than the size of someone's head. It's more important than racializing people. So he invites the Kwakawakawak, personally invites them to come to the fair to put on their performance, in part because he's impressed with them. He knows they're colorful and enchanting. On the other hand, he's struggling with his own ambivalence about whether these people are a vanishing culture or a culture that deserves more respect than an awful lot of other anthropologists at the fair think. Most of the anthropologists at the fair are there basically to wish farewell to the disappearing people. So what I think is probably the most important thing to understand about the Kwakawakawak is that they very self-consciously and intentionally came to the Chicago Expo with a plan to deliver a message, the same message they took to Germany when they were on their tour, same message that was shown to Boas in Germany. He didn't get it then, probably isn't going to get it at the Expo either, but the message that the Kwakawakawak have to deliver is, look, we're not simple-minded primitives. We're not a static society caught in a rut, unable to change and adapt. Our dance is about transformation and about change. And that's who we are and who we've always been. Let us show you a dance with that theme, and maybe you'll understand how we aren't going to vanish, how we're going to adapt. So it's a wonderful message, which I think has some modern resonance, about transcending threatening circumstances in the environment and in the political and social climate around. Now, that has to sound familiar to contemporaries, 21st century people listening to this program, because we are afflicted with the same kinds of anxieties.
Well, it also seems to me, obviously, we can look back with the wisdom of hindsight and feel that the Kwakwakawak were naive, thinking that they'd be looked at respectfully and that their message would get through to the people coming to this triumphalist expo. But to me, it's actually the same category of, if you're the first person from your minority group to have a seat at the table at some decision making that formerly you were excluded from, chances are you're going to take it and you're going to give it your best effort, because it's what you've got to work from. And I think you have to cast some hope and some optimism out that your communications are going to reach at least somebody and do some good.
Well, as we mentioned on a previous program about Black Elk, you know, he joined Buffalo Bill's Wild West show as it toured Europe because it was an opportunity for him and his contemporaries to deliver a similar message about, look, we're being misrepresented. We want to show you who we really are. And again, when you're totally marginalized, you know, as you said, this is sometimes the best shot you can get. But I think what we need to do now is, since we've been leading people, you know, through the fair, is to get a little bit away from the immediate thing in front of us, which is this very abbreviated, out of context performance of a very colorful dance, which we'll be describing in a minute here, and understand how that dance was actually performed and what it actually meant in the context of the society of the Kwakwakawak from the Pacific Northwest. Because that dance, that performance, reflected the times, not some frozen moment in ancient history, immemorial, you know, unchanging. it reflected those circumstances, and that's what's on display at the expo, and that's what we need to understand.
So, listeners and readers, we're about to shift, when we finish this segment, to look at things from the Kwakwaka'wakw perspective in their own context. So we're going to bid farewell to this expo. See you in a minute. We'll take our first break. Stay tuned.
Rights for nature? Around the globe, indigenous communities, governments, and environmental groups are realizing that human rights aren't enough to protect the planet. They're passing laws that recognize rivers, forests, and mountains as having rights of their own, rights that include the right of those ecosystems to exist and flourish. These actions are beginning to make a real difference. Find out more about this work by visiting the Center for Democratic and Environmental Rights webpage at centerforenvironmentalrights.org.
Period poverty. If you don't know what it is, you should, because you can help. 1 in 4 American women struggle to purchase menstruation products this year, resulting in missed school and even loss of income. The Native American Women's Nonprofit, Kwek Society, cares enough to give Native American students and communities their period products, and they do it across North America. Please help women with your time, donations, or supplies to maintain their dignity and celebrate their strength during moon time. Visit kweksociety.org. That's K-W-E-K Society.
Listen up. The source for information and inspirational items about the struggle and wisdom of indigenous people is the Syracuse Cultural Workers. They are committed to peace, sustainability, social justice, feminism, and multiculturalism, and they create beautiful visual materials like calendars, t-shirts, cards, and more, including their Greetings and Thanks to the Natural World accordion poster that offers daily grounding for our relationship to the earth and its many fellow beings. Get so many wonderful items. Go there now. SyracuseCulturalWorkers.com.
Randy Krakowski's book, Without Reservation, describes his spiritual awakening as a Native American. It's a powerful, life-changing story where Randy shares his journey into the realm of ancestral Native American connections and explores his encounters with Mother Earth. The book actually helps you how to reconnect with your ancestors to rekindle your access to ancestral wisdom and nature. Available in print, ebook, and audiobook format, Get Without Reservation by Randy Krakowski from all major booksellers. For more information, visit Randy Krakowski.
Citizen Potawatomi Nation's Cultural Heritage Center, located near Shawnee, Oklahoma, features 11 immersive galleries with digital and interactive exhibits. Visitors learn about the tribe's history from origin to modern days and gain an understanding of Citizen Potawatomi oral traditions and lifeways. Admission is always free. Open Monday through Friday from 8 a.m. to 5 p.m., Saturday 10 a.m. to 3 p.m. Visit the Cultural Heritage Center on the web at PotawatomiHeritage.com.
Welcome back to Indigenous Perspectives and our show on transformation and survival. So we're traveling now to the Pacific Northwest Coast, looking at the Kwakwaka'wakw Raven Dancers, and we're looking at what was happening with these dances, why they were so important, and why they were changing during the late 19th century. So, Randy, start us off.
So, first of all, we need to understand that this society was experiencing demographic collapse on a scale that's hard for us to imagine. Many people know that something like 90% of the indigenous population of the country was eliminated either through warfare or more often disease and starvation. This afflicted the Kwakwaka'wakw. They were not exempt. So entire villages, entire communities vanished from the face of the earth. Others had their population decreased so much that many villages had to basically combine their societies in order to be able to carry on. And when a majority of the people in the village or the community disappear, basically all of the social structures collapse. You know, there aren't people for leadership positions. There aren't people even to do simple tasks like, you know, fishing and hunting. So it's a crisis. I hate to use the word that's overused today, but it was an existential crisis for the Kwakwaka'wakw.
And so, for other people in the Pacific Northwest coast as well.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So one of the things that was imploding was the kinship networks that were the very backbone of Quack Waka Wak society. Who you were in the community, the authority you had in the community, the rights you had for fishing and hunting, all related to your kinship network. And if that collapses, then customary law is threatened. So the Quack Waka Wak are determined to put, in a sense, you know, Humpty Dumpty back together again and recreate out of the fragments, surviving fragments of their culture, something new. Now, to make the situation even more complicated, the Canadian government had basically imposed a new form of governance on the Quack Waka Wak. They appointed tribal councils, and in some cases let the people in the community vote for their tribal leaders. But those new methods of governance replaced the old methods of governance based on customary law and kinship and traditional chiefs. So everything virtually is turned upside down.
I want to just clarify, even for today, I think there's that tension among many Indigenous nations between the hereditary leaders, the clan leaders, the hereditary chiefs, whatever that particular nation has as a structure, and the council or the sort of official recognized government that deals directly with the United States bureaucracies. Is that accurate?
That is accurate. And we're at the time we're looking in the late 19th century, this was just beginning to take hold.
Okay. So we've got the scene of the Quack Waka Wak dealing with massive threats to their very existence. So we're going to look at one of the many dances. It's a raven dance, a fragment of which was performed at the Chicago Expo. And a wonderful thing to start off with is that these dances are performed to this day. The whole movement, the form, the stories are going strong. There are many wonderful examples available on YouTube of traditional dances in this Raven Cycle and others performed in recent years by the Quack Waka Wak in particular. So that's where we're going to start.
We will put references to those in the print version of our podcast in our transcript so that those who'd like to see what this actually looked like can do so. It's hard to put into words how absolutely awesome these are, but here we go. We're going to try.
Yeah, we've done this based on looking at YouTube videos, so it's our best effort.
So for the Quack Waka Wak, this raven dance, the one that we're referring to that took place in Chicago, it's a ceremony marking the transition of someone from being a youth in the community, and he is going to go through a process and emerge into adulthood and leadership by virtue of becoming a member in a prestigious secret society. Secret societies and members of them basically literally owned the rights to perform these dances. And these dances are what anthropologists call a rite of passage, you know, a mechanism, a ceremonial marking of moving from one stage in life to another stage in life. So the youth is seeking to be initiated, and he first spends time in the forest before the dance. Days in other records, it would suggest a week or more, fasting, undergoing really strenuous fasting, sometimes not even drinking water, to the point where people begin to hallucinate. And during this vision quest in the forest, the youth encounters, because of cultural expectations, relationships with all kinds of spirits. Some of them are pretty dark and not particularly welcoming because for Native Americans, they knew that the forest and the world around them contained all kinds of spirits, some friendly, some unfriendly, and some friendly sometimes and not at others, uh-huh. Like bear spirit. So this youth is in the forest, and One of the spirits he encounters is Crooked Beak, who in Kwakwaka society is the cannibal. The spirit represents everything that is the antithesis of order and communal life. So essentially, on his vision quest, he's encountering everything that's not in the village or doesn't belong in the village.
So he sort of has to figure out how to survive and not get drawn into the world of these evil beings?
That's not his job. He is being drawn into that, according to the ceremony. He returns to the village virtually a wild person. He's been uncivilized. So he enters a giant lodge, beautiful building, with four totem poles surrounding an open space. There's an earthen floor and a fire burning in a pit in the center. And then community members are seated around to watch the transition.
So three dancers enter to the beat of drums and chants. The dancers wear large, colorfully painted, red, black, and white, carved wooden bird-like masks. The masks have prominent beaks. They're either curved or straight. The beaks stick out about 4 feet from the dancers' heads. And the dancers wear capes and skirts made of cedar bark, which sway with their movements. Their dance movements are deliberate. They involve high-stepping footwork. The masks cock their heads from side to side. They swing. They move ponderously. Also, at times, the birds' beaks open, and then they click closed, which adds another dimension of sound to the drum beats. Each dancer has an assistant who accompanies his movements with a rattle, helps him stand up and sit down fluidly, even in the heavy mask, and who also activates the strings that open and close the beak. When the bird's dance is over, they exit. And the young initiate, he's dressed in a cedar bark outfit. He's brought in, escorted by two others, one on each side, holding him really tightly. They whirl him around and present him to the onlookers at each of the four sections of the audience before they also exit.
So taken all together, this is a dramatic and spellbinding performance for the audience that's telling them the story of Crooked Beak's challenge to Raven, who is the hero in this story, and also it's a story about Raven's eventual triumph.
So we could say the ceremony has struggled to assert the power of life and the social and spiritual order against destruction and chaos as represented by Crooked Beak.
Yes, and everyone in the room at the time would have understood that that chaos is very largely the white society that has conquered them. So what we're looking at essentially here is a purification ceremony where the evil spiritual influence that has occupied this, possessed, if you wish, this young man is slowly extracted and overcome. And the subtext, which is not at all subtle, that everyone would have gotten is, this is our struggle with colonial society.
Okay. Stay tuned, listeners. We'll be back in a minute with to continue our discussion.
Rights for nature? Around the globe, indigenous communities, governments, and environmental groups are realizing that human rights aren't enough to protect the planet. They're passing laws that recognize rivers, forests, and mountains as having rights of their own, rights that include the right of those ecosystems to exist and flourish. These actions are beginning to make a real difference. Find out more about this work by visiting the Center for Democratic and Environmental Rights webpage at centerforenvironmentalrights.org.
Randy Krakowski's book, Without Reservation, describes his spiritual awakening as a Native American. It's a powerful, life-changing story where Randy shares his journey into the realm of ancestral Native American connections and explores his encounters with Mother Earth. The book actually helps you how to reconnect with your ancestors to rekindle your access to ancestral wisdom and nature. Available in print, ebook, and audiobook format, Get Without Reservation by Randy Krakowski from all major booksellers. For more information, visit Randy Krakowski.
Located near Shawnee, Oklahoma, Citizen Potawatomi Nation is Potawatomi County's largest employer with a rich history and culture as a sovereign Native nation. Learn more about CPN by visiting its website, which includes information on services for members, tribal enterprises, government and constitution, the newspaper, and much more. All at potawatomi.org. That's PotawaTomi.org.
Period poverty. If you don't know what it is, you should, because you can help. One in four American women struggle to purchase menstruation products this year, resulting in missed school and even loss of income. The Native American Women's Nonprofit, Kwek Society, cares enough to give Native American students and communities their period products, and they do it across North America. Please help women with your time, donations, or supplies to maintain their dignity and celebrate their strength during moon time. Visit kweksociety.org. That's K-W-E-K Society.
Don't get angry. Anger is a negative emotion that suppresses your immune system that may cause health problems. Make a positive difference by working together to protect and support your family, friends, and community. Take a break from the dark side. Uplifting and enlightening. Listen to the positive side of podcasts. HRNradio.com.
Welcome back to Indigenous Perspectives, and we're picking up our discussion of transformation and the Kwok Waka Wok.
To remind our listeners, we have now traveled to the Pacific Northwest. We're watching the ceremony, and we have left our young initiate standing in this giant lodge in an altered state. And what I want to begin this segment by emphasizing is that he is now a unique individual in the community. He has been touched by living spirits in the forest, the most powerful forces in Kwok Waka society. And he has become, through that process, a bridge between ordinary life, ordinary people, and the spirit world.
And this is special for the young man with this special ceremony, but the whole community understands they're all intimately and continually connected to the spirit world, right?
But not as connected as someone who undergoes this transformation, not as much as someone who is initiated into this secret society and will become a knowledge keeper and a bridge, a broker, conduit, if you wish, to the spirit world. So his transformation is indeed just one of many transformations that happen in dances in the Kwok Waka Wok society, and they involve other masks. Some of the masks, which again you can see in the videos that we'll give links in our print transcript, some of the videos are masks that literally open up to expose a face within the mask, a mask within the mask. It's absolutely astounding to see it. And what the viewers would understand is that within the spirit mask of a raven or a whale is a human, that there is no distinction, no radical distinction between humans and other spirits and other living beings, including wildlife.
And the dancers would also be having a very powerful experience every time they perform the dance, because they're not just taking a role, but they have to live it to a certain extent.
That is correct. The masks are not things. They are objects in museums today, and people collect them and put them on their walls. But for the Kwok Waka Wok, these are animate beings, living beings, not just because the parts move with little mechanical devices, but because the spirit within them makes them animated, makes them come alive.
So these are not masks that should be or made for to be hung on a wall in isolation. They're meant to be masks that participate in the ceremonies and dances that carry all these messages.
Right. So this celebration, this ceremony that we're seeing, is just one of many that would happen continually, including at potlatches in this society, whereby the gates, if you wish, between this world and the spirit world open. And what the Kwak Waka Wak are doing is they're consciously activating those connections, because they understand that without a spiritual transformation and recreation and re-energizing of their nearly broken society, they aren't going to be able to transcend the threats that surround them.
So they're using the dances to basically piece back together the most fundamental aspects of their societies: kinship among humans, kinship linking humans and non-humans, including the spirit world. So their cosmology is being seriously threatened by so many circumstances. They're responding with these dances. I think a lot of us are feeling this kind of threat today, but we don't have today, mainstream society, we don't seem to have ceremony to express our angst or our hopes or different ways to connect ourselves and heal our communities. We don't have ceremonies that touch us really deeply, I don't think. People just read the news and suffer. They don't know what to do. Or they look to technological fixes, like, you know, get a better computer or a new gadget.
So that's why we're doing this very show. We're trying to offer some alternative model, some hope, of ways of coping with what was a very real threat for 19th century Kwak Waka Wak, and for what we, many of us today, feel is a very, very real threat. We have young people in great numbers around the world who are expressing their fears in organizations like Extinction Rebellion. Sounds an awful lot like the message at the Chicago Expo of these people are vanishing. Only this time, it's not the lower levels on the evolutionary tree. It's the people who have reached the acme of the evolutionary tree saying it about themselves. But the difference is that the indigenous people, as you said, have ceremonial ways of coping with this. We wallow in our own individual angst.
And they're also, again, this keeps hitting me really strongly. The whole point about these dances, this raven dance we gave the example of, is one of many. The dances themselves change. Dances change over time. They change in response to the audience. The original of the dance we described was actually created by a different Northwestern people, the Heiltsuk, and through intermarriage and through some kinship arrangements, the Kwak Waka Wak got a hold of the dance and used it for their own selves. They integrated it with their other ideas and moved things forward. So I think it's really important, because it's time for us to cast off the idea that indigenous societies were stuck in transitions and traditions. The traditions were unchanging. Yes, these are important traditions, but they're changing over time. The people are changing them, transforming them to meet their needs. So I think that's a really important point.
So if the Kwak Waka Wak could borrow from other indigenous societies to promote their spiritual revival and survival, maybe there's a lesson there. And I think a lot of us in contemporary society are learning that as we're trying to borrow elements from indigenous society to revitalize our own society.
Okay, well, stay tuned. We'll be back in a minute with segment 4.
Rights for nature? Around the globe, indigenous communities, governments, and environmental groups are realizing that human rights aren't enough to protect the planet. They're passing laws that recognize rivers, forests, and mountains as having rights of their own, rights that include the right of those ecosystems to exist and flourish. These actions are beginning to make a real difference. Find out more about this work by visiting the Center for Democratic and Environmental Rights webpage at centerforenvironmentalrights.org.
Period poverty. If you don't know what it is, you should, because you can help. 1 in 4 American women struggle to purchase menstruation products this year, resulting in missed school and even loss of income. The Native American Women's Nonprofit, Kwek Society, cares enough to give Native American students and communities their period products, and they do it across North America. Please help women with your time, donations, or supplies to maintain their dignity and celebrate their strength during moon time. Visit kweksociety.org. That's K-W-E-K Society.org.
Listen up. The source for information and inspirational items about the struggle and wisdom of indigenous people is the Syracuse Cultural Workers. They are committed to peace, sustainability, social justice, feminism, and multiculturalism, and they create beautiful visual materials like calendars, t-shirts, cards, and more, including their Greetings and Thanks to the Natural World accordion poster that offers daily grounding for our relationship to the earth and its many fellow beings. Get so many wonderful items. Go there now. SyracuseCulturalWorkers.com.
Randy Krakowski's book, Without Reservation, describes his spiritual awakening as a Native American. It's a powerful, life-changing story where Randy shares his journey into the realm of ancestral Native American connections and explores his encounters with Mother Earth. The book actually helps you how to reconnect with your ancestors to rekindle your access to ancestral wisdom and nature. Available in print, ebook, and audiobook format, Get Without Reservation by Randy Krakowski from all major booksellers. For more information, visit Randy Krakowski.
Citizen Potawatomi Nation's Cultural Heritage Center, located near Shawnee, Oklahoma, features 11 immersive galleries with digital and interactive exhibits. Visitors learn about the tribe's history from origin to modern days and gain an understanding of Citizen Potawatomi oral traditions and lifeways. Admission is always free. Open Monday through Friday from 8 a.m. to 5 p.m., Saturday 10 a.m. to 3 p.m. Visit the Cultural Heritage Center on the web at PotawatomiHeritage.com.
Where positive people and radio unite. HealthyLife.net.
Way high up, way high up, hey, oh, way high up, hey, oh. Way high up, way high up, hey, oh, way high up, hey, oh. Way high up, hey, oh. Way high up.
Welcome back to our program on transformation and survival. In this segment, I'm going to answer the question that might be on several people's minds, which is, so the Kwakwaka'wakw have succeeded in finding a way of engaging in their own spiritual transformation. So what? How really significant is that in the broader scheme of things? So what I want to show in this segment is that that transformation of a small community of indigenous people in the Pacific Northwest was enormously influential on the broader world around us and on contemporary problems that all of us see as in the forefront of our concern. First of all, what they did is they succeeded in getting the Canadian government, the Kwakwaka'wakw and other Pacific Northwest tribes succeeded in getting the Canadian government's Fisheries Commission, which was doing a horrific job of controlling overfishing on the Pacific coast. They succeeded in getting them to change their rules. They did this by confronting this bureaucracy, going out in their canoes and surrounding giant ocean trawlers and embarrassing the Canadian government. They embarrassed the Canadian government because they got on TV. You know, it's like the mouse that roared, you know, the little canoes around the big trawler. They used their moral force. And to have that moral force, they had to dig deep within their own spiritual strength and their own new conviction to do this. Now, we're talking here about the 21st century. This happened fairly recently. But the story goes deeper and goes back further than that. It goes back to the time period we were visiting a few minutes ago when we looked at the Kwakwaka'wakw and the transformation ceremony of this young initiate. What that ceremony did, as we said, is it recreated and re-energized the kinship system in the village, the very foundation of the society. Well, what's the connection between the kinship system and saving fish? It's very simple and it's very beautiful. traditional chiefs had the right to set fishing limits for the people in their own village and neighboring villages when neighboring villages came to fish in their territory. They used their authority, which they derived from their status in the community, which came from the kinds of dances and ceremony that we were talking about. It was their mechanism for saying, this is who I am, this is who my kin are, these are the people that respect my ruling on how many clams, how many fish can be caught. So we're finding an entire giant, powerful bureaucracy subject to the industrial influence of an incredibly powerful fishing industry upended by people who, in the 21st century, had discovered at the end of the 19th century how to put their broken culture back together again and make its kinship network an enforcement mechanism for customary law that protects the environment. So what we have, in a very roundabout way, is an example of how reconstituting oneself, first spiritually and then socially, can be transformative, not just for the people in that society, but for Mother Earth herself. This is a really significant and wondrous story.
And one of the many things that keeps coming back to me is the importance of the fact that the Kwakwaka'wakw did these achievements by working within their communities. Again, you said they dug deep. They found the things of value to carry on. And I think an important point is telling ourselves stories about ourselves as humans that indicate our capacity to be self-transformative is really important, so we don't just dissolve into a puddle of despair. And it's important also not just to have some highly individual weekend retreat, but to work with other people to create the communities and to reach out and connect in a positive way. So I think those are just words, but the Kwakwaka'wakw did it.
They did it. And more importantly, they're still doing it. And they're still doing it absolutely wondrously and in some ways more effectively than some of our very strong, legally supported, financially supported organizations can't seem to be able to achieve similar results. There's a lesson here. It should be obvious, and it should be comforting to the listeners.
Okay. So in conclusion, we've taken our listeners on a long and circuitous journey. We've gone back through time and returned to the present, and we've done this in order to give you some sense of the formidable challenges and astounding transformations that the Kwakwaka'wakw actions exemplify. They were written off as quote-unquote vanishing Indians at the 1893 Chicago Expo, presented as living exhibits of a culture that was reimagined and only partly understood, if that, by the organizers. We saw that their culture, its masks, its dances, and its rituals were a bit commodified for Expo attendees, but they didn't let that drag them down. They then went back home. They're dealing with economic and governance obstacles, but instead of collapse, they recover, they recreate, they transform. It impacted not only the Kwakwaka'wakw, but the governments that had been attempting to erase them. The Kwakwaka'wakw restored, reinvigorated their ceremonies, reconstituted their social structure and the significance, the moral force of the traditional leaders. It became strong enough to transform how U.S. and Canadian authorities manage nature in and on coastal fisheries. So this story is a start of an answer to the question that mainstream friends often ask, are we going to make it? They're referring to the daily drumbeat of news about ecological, political, social collapses. So we hope this program will provide an alternative to doom scrolling, compulsively checking the latest news about catastrophes as if merely staying tuned to such developments will be transformative. It won't be. We've shown real living examples of cultures and peoples who faced unimaginable threats to their very existence, transformed themselves, kept reaching out, And in so doing, began the long and arduous work of transforming mainstream society as well. So I hope this broadcast has given you time and space to reconnect with your roots and Mother Earth and your ancestral roots. Before your busy day distracts you from this moment, we encourage you to reach out and feel the presence of living flora and fauna, our animate kin, and perhaps even that of your ancestors and others who have walked on. Allow yourself to touch their presence, capture that moment, and to hold on to it. And if you wish, write to Randy, let him know about your experiences or with any questions or suggestions you have for these shows. Randy can be reached at his email, randykutkowski@hushmail.com, or through his website, which is www.randykutkowski.com. Miigwech to all.
Miigwech.
Located near Shawnee, Oklahoma, Citizen Potawatomi Nation is Potawatomi County's largest employer with a rich history and culture as a sovereign Native nation. Learn more about CPN by visiting its website, which includes information on services for members, tribal enterprises, government and constitution, the newspaper, and much more. All at potawatomi.org. That's PotawatomiOrg.
Randy Krakowski's book, Without Reservation, describes his spiritual awakening as a Native American. It's a powerful, life-changing story where Randy shares his journey into the realm of ancestral Native American connections and explores his encounters with Mother Earth. The book actually helps you how to reconnect with your ancestors to rekindle your access to ancestral wisdom and nature. Available in print, ebook, and audiobook format, Get Without Reservation by Randy Krakowski from all major booksellers. For more information, visit Randy Krakowski.
Citizen Potawatomi Nation's Cultural Heritage Center, located near Shawnee, Oklahoma, features 11 immersive galleries with digital and interactive exhibits. Visitors learn about the tribe's history from origin to modern days and gain an understanding of Citizen Potawatomi oral traditions and lifeways. Admission is always free. Open Monday through Friday from 8 a.m. to 5 p.m., Saturday 10 a.m. to 3 p.m. Visit the Cultural Heritage Center on the web at PotawatomiHeritage.com. Remember, help for a positive life. www.healthylife.net.